Coming up, the migrant crisis in Europe. What should the U.S. do? And how are faith-based groups trying to help? Also, Kim Lawton reports on the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, the Vatican document that dramatically changed interfaith relations, especially between Catholics and Jews. Plus, Lucky Severson on a university working to offer many students a more practical and less expensive education.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Again this week, religion played a key role in violence between Israelis and Palestinians. The violence began weeks ago over rumors that Israel was plotting to take over the site known to Jews as the Temple Mount and to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. This week, the UN's Cultural Heritage Agency, UNESCO, condemned what it called Israeli aggressions against Muslims' access to their holy site. The Israeli government and several Jewish groups strongly criticized the statement. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu further stoked tensions when he suggested that the then Muslim Mufti of Jerusalem helped convince Hitler to exterminate Jews. That suggestion was denounced by many experts. Meanwhile, international political and religious leaders continue appealing for calm. Pope Francis urged both sides to show great courage and strength to work for peace. At the Vatican, bishops from more than 120 nations are wrapping up a nearly three-week-long synod or meeting about family issues. Francis urged open debate, and the synod has indeed been marked by sharp disagreements, especially over teachings about Catholics who are divorced or gay. The bishops are writing recommendations about how the church can best minister to different kinds of families. They submit those recommendations to Francis this weekend, and he will decide what to do with them. Here in the U.S., interfaith leaders urged the nation to recommit to protecting the rights of all religious believers. Representatives from several religious traditions held an interfaith prayer service at Washington National Cathedral. The service was co-sponsored by Shoulder to Shoulder, an interfaith group that fights discrimination against Muslims. Participants at the event specifically called on politicians and public officials to oppose bigotry, hate, and discrimination against people of all faiths. Security has been heightened around churches in the St. Louis area after recent arson attacks. Since the beginning of October, fires have been set at several churches across racial and denominational lines. There's been varying amounts of damage. Religious groups around the nation have expressed concern about the attacks. Record numbers of Syrians, Iraqis, and North Africans continue to flood into Europe. The European Union says more than 700,000 migrants have entered EU countries so far this year, more than twice as many as the total in 2014. The numbers have generated a massive humanitarian crisis. Here to talk more about this is our managing editor, Kim Lawton, and Sean Callahan, Chief Operating Officer of Catholic Relief Services. Sean is just back from the Balkans, where thousands of migrants keep arriving every day. Sean, welcome. How many refugees did you see at the time you were in the Balkans?
We actually saw several hundred as busloads had come up from the border of Macedonia to the border of Serbia and Croatia through the country of Serbia.
And what were the needs? I mean, what kinds of needs were you seeing, and are people able to meet those needs?
Right now, they need more and more winterization needs, some hygiene, because many of them have been traveling for between 6 and 10 weeks, and then care for children, some baby food, warm clothing, blankets, and things of that nature.
Between governments and the relief agencies, are they getting what they need?
They are getting what they need in the areas and the countries of transition. And so many of these countries, the Albania, Macedonia, Croatia, Hungary, they're transiting through relatively quickly. So they are getting that immediate need and even some legal assistance. But I think the bigger need is going to be in the area of resettlement.
And where are they trying to go?
You know, the vast majority of the population was targeting Germany.
Talk about the challenges for the relief groups, the humanitarian groups that are working in these areas.
You know, I think the biggest challenge is this isn't a refugee crisis where everything is set from day one through the crisis. On a daily basis, people shift locations, and they're using cell phones to communicate what route has been closed, what route is open. So you have to have an agility to respond in one area of the country and then move it fast to another area of the country.
Sean, when you were there, did you hear any people, any of the Europeans, talking about the possibility that there might be terrorists among these people coming in?
You know, we've heard rumors of that. We met with the ministers and that we met with some people in the country. And frankly, particularly in Serbia and in Croatia at this time, most of the people weren't as worried about that as we've heard in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that there's a lot of interfaith dimensions to this crisis. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we've been very pleased that this region, which has been subject to a lot of religious strife over the years, people have come together, and we have actually found that it's really uniting some of the local populations. We often hear of the tragedies and some of the complaints about people coming in that are outsiders. Mostly what we've seen is people uniting, bringing welcoming gifts, warm clothes and things, and joining in as volunteers in this humanitarian effort.
You were testifying this week up at the Capitol about what the United States should be doing. What's the number one thing we should be doing?
Well, the United States has done a lot of great assistance over the last several years with this crisis, $4.5 billion, and I think we need to keep that up, keep that assistance up, and support our European partners because they are facing the brunt of this challenge right now.
What about resettling people here? There have been varying calls to bring more people here, and then there's been some opposition to that. What are you recommending?
We are recommending. The U.S. Has only resettled about 1,700 so far during this crisis, and the administration has now said that they'll expand it to about 10,000. What we'd like to do is see at the call of Pope Francis is that we all open our doors a little bit more. And we expedite the process. Currently, for the refugees to get in, it takes about 18 to 24 months for them to be reviewed, and we'd like to expedite that because these families are in tragic situations and really need to move quick.
And very briefly, what needs to happen here to prepare to receive them? Are we ready to receive them?
Well, I think some of the recipient organizations, like Catholic Charities, our partner organization in the United States, and the communities need to understand some of the culture and history of these people coming in. But some of the initial resettlements we've heard have been very positive, and communities have been showing their compassion and really welcoming them in.
Sean Callahan, many thanks. Really good of you to come in.
Thank you.
And Kim Lawton, many thanks to you. This coming week marks the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, the landmark Vatican document that opened the way for dialogue between the Catholic Church and other religions. The document profoundly changed Catholic-Jewish relations. Kim Lawton looks at the continuing impact of Nostra Aetate.
During his visit to New York last month, Pope Francis was part of an emotional interfaith service at the 9/11 memorial. Representatives from more than a dozen religious traditions joined the Pope to talk about peace and to pray for it.
50 years ago, that would never have happened. 100 years ago, it had been laughable and unthinkable. And 500 years ago, we'd all be under arrest, even for trying it.
Reverend Dennis McManus assisted at the gathering. He's a professor at Georgetown University and the U.S. Catholic Bishop's consultant on Jewish affairs. He says the 9/11 service and all of the Catholic Church's interfaith dialogue can take place because of Nostra Aetate.
This document is big. It's big because of the way it helps the Church relate to others, and it's big because it helps the Church relate to herself in a new way.
Nostra Aetate had a dramatic impact on the Church's relationship with the Jewish community in particular. Rabbi Noam Marins directs interreligious and intergroup relations at the American Jewish Committee.
It was a game changer for how the Jewish people were to be understood by the giant of Western religions, Christianity.
Nostra Aetate is Latin for in our time. The declaration was approved in 1965 in the Second Vatican Council, where bishops were meeting to make a host of changes to Catholic teachings and practice. The document said the Church can recognize truth in other religions and urges dialogue with followers of other faiths. A significant part of the declaration addressed Catholic teaching about Jews. For much of Christian history, the Church had held what had become known as a teaching of contempt, that all Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus and that God had therefore rejected them. Marin says this created an environment that led to the Inquisition, pogroms, and Jewish ghettos.
Ultimately, these teachings of hate and animosity are going to lead to violence against Jews. And that's exactly what happened. Jews lost their lives because of this teaching.
McManus says in the aftermath of the Holocaust, church leaders began to re-examine what was being taught.
Nostra Aetate has its roots in the shame and realizations of Christians after the Holocaust for what has been done to Jews. Following the horror of discovering in the camps what the Nazi project was about, seeing the flood of refugees of Jews to all of Europe, bishops, pastors, everyone become aware and ashamed and say, we must begin to address this deep historical prejudice.
Pope John XXIII was the primary force behind the change.
When he was a papal nuncio in several capitals in Europe, among other things, creating false baptismal certificates for Jews so that they could impersonate Christians. And then he called for the Second Vatican Council and he made this relationship with the Jewish people, a reevaluation of that, part of that conversation.
Through Nostra Aetate, the council clearly repudiated the teaching of contempt.
The teaching of the church was now that the Jews could not be accused of the deicide charge, that Jews then and now were not collectively responsible for the death of Jesus, that Jews could no longer be presented as accursed.
If Jesus was Jewish, his followers are Jewish, the scriptures are Jewish, the liturgy has Jewish roots, then Christianity has its roots in Judaism. And nothing but trouble will result from separating a community from its roots. And this document says, bring that back together.
As a result, church leaders began making changes in textbooks and in parts of the liturgy, such as Good Friday prayers, which had referred to, quote, perfidious Jews.
What you hear on Sunday, what you hear in Holy Week, what you hear on Good Friday, what you hear in the sacraments, when you marry, when you bury, when you're forgiven sins, if it's anti-Jewish, it seeps into us like a kind of toxin. That kind of change in the liturgy has meant everything in the way Catholics understand Jews and Judaism.
Pope John Paul II expanded Nostra Aetate further.
The first pope to visit a synagogue, Catholics like to say, since Peter. The pope that went to Holocaust sites and there, on bended knee, began to acknowledge the complicity of Christianity in the crime of the Shoah.
As John Paul would say later, it isn't enough to say that anti-Semitism in its many forms is not acceptable. Let me put it to you simply. Anti-Semitism in any form is a sin, and no Christian may have anything to do with it and call himself a follower of Jesus. He is that blunt.
Catholic and Jewish leaders alike say Nostra Aetate paved the way for new dialogue and joint projects, all which built mutual understanding that continues to grow.
We no longer approach each other in dialogue with grievances, with complaints, with the desire to defeat each other. We come instead to say, how do we work together?
The foundation enables the conversation to be among friends. It means that if there are disagreements, they can be spoken about between friends.
Many say Pope Francis has further solidified Catholic-Jewish relations. He had many Jewish friends in Argentina, including his close friend, Rabbi Abraham Skorka, with whom he wrote a book.
He is the first pope in the 20th century who did not see the darkening clouds over Europe from World War I or the horribleness of World War II and the Holocaust. He's the first one who is a truly post-World War II pope.
Pope Francis is living proof of the success of the Nostra Aetate revolution. We perhaps have moved from revolution and evolution towards normalization, ultimately a much more healthy relationship.
And in an all too often polarized world, many say healthy interfaith relationships are needed now more than ever. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Now, trying to meet the growing demand for colleges and universities to prepare more students for good jobs at far less cost. Lucky Severson reports from Arizona State University.
When Michael Crow took over Arizona State University, he had what he called a moonshot dream to create the new American university.
Moonshot projects are very large, audacious goals and objectives that people think are not possible, and makes them possible.
In the beginning, there are a lot of disbelievers. This is Fred Corey, ASU Vice Provost.
When President Crow arrived, many people thought, oh, he's just going to be here for a few years. He's just using this as a stepping stone to something else. Ignore him, it'll go away.
Mark Killian was for many years with the Arizona Board of Regents. Now he's director of the state's Department of Agriculture.
I thought he was a loudmouth. I thought he was cocky. In fact, I was in a meeting with a group of legislators trying to talk about ASU, and I couldn't get him to shut up. And when the meeting was over, I thought, how am I ever going to sell ASU? I got to get this guy to quit talking.
Listen to Killian today.
He's into creative destruction. He took a university that was known as a party school, that was okay university, and he has totally changed that into a first-class academic institution.
Michael Crow happens to be a particularly innovative leader.
Zoe Baird is president of the Marco Foundation, a charitable organization that collaborates with innovators to promote the advancement of knowledge.
And so what Michael is doing at ASU is he is making it possible for people, whenever they're ready in their lifetime, to get their college diploma.
U.S. News & World Report ranked ASU number 2 among up-and-coming schools, and it ranks number 3 in the number of students who are Fulbright scholars. That's one reason Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz teamed up with Crow and ASU to create a new program that provides free online education for Starbucks employees or partners. If these partners work 20 hours a week and get passing grades, Starbucks picks up the tab for their education.
They have tens of thousands of their partners who went to college and never graduated. We have the way to help them to graduate, to overcome this financial burden that many of those students that started college and never finished. You know, it's one thing to start college, have debt, and have a degree. It's another thing to start college, have debt, and not graduate.
Partners like Barbara Boyer, who is a new manager of Starbucks in Gilbert, Arizona.
I don't think that I'd be enrolled currently. I think that would have been a dream that would have been put on hold for a long time, maybe till my kids were a little older.
Yeah, we think that it's better to start finding ways to measure schools based on what they produce versus who you don't admit.
The acceptance rate at some of the top schools like Stanford, Yale, and Harvard is less than 7%. ASU accepts over 80%. That's partly because ASU starts preparing future students while they're still in high school and even earlier. This was a failed school in a bad neighborhood before ASU took it over and turned it into a prep school, grades K through 12.
This is a different school. We're not just getting them ready to graduate from the high school. We're getting them ready to graduate from the university, and that begins as early as preschool.
Deborah Gonzalez is the chief academic officer, and most of her students come from high poverty areas where English is a second language.
76% of the seniors who graduated were accepted to a four-year university. All of the seniors who graduated were admitted to either a two-year, four-year program or a four-year program.
All of them.
All of the students who graduated.
To make it easier, cheaper, and quicker to get into the university, ASU offers an online roadmap for students who want to transfer, usually from two-year colleges. Martin Garcia is a senior.
If I didn't have this program, I wouldn't have taken the correct classes that would transfer over to ASU. So it basically set me up so that I wasn't wasting time, money, on classes that I didn't need.
Carletta Miller is married with two kids. She went to a two-year college and transferred here.
I am an ASU transfer student ambassador, where I go back to the community colleges and talk to potential students who are looking at coming to ASU from a student perspective on the transfer process, and that's something that I take great pride in.
There are so many programs here to encourage kids to enroll and then not to drop out. An incoming student has an enrollment counselor, curriculum and financial aid advisors, and a success coach.
It's not an easy transition for an 18-year-old. So we create a team of people who are there to help that student and there to sort of be that safety net is what we call our success coach.
This space-age building is where ASU houses its online operations. The school has about 20,000 online students, counting Starbucks employees. Leah Lummel is in charge.
Whether they come to ASU in the long run or not isn't our primary goal of Global Freshman Academy. It's to get them started and believe in themselves.
Global Freshman Academy is only one of ASU's online programs. It allows high school students or anyone to take online courses at ASU at no cost. Then if they do well and want credit, the school charges them a reduced tuition and accepts them as students.
We're not just looking at getting someone in, we're really looking at making them successful, teaching them to be master learners in life and how to contribute back to their communities when they're done.
Crow has grown the number of students at ASU to 70,000 who attend classes at five campuses in Phoenix. 4 out of 10 students come from low-income families. In many cases, they are the first in their family to attend college. ASU ranks as one of the more affordable universities for in-state tuition.
The elite schools will say, well, we have lots of kids from lower income families. And the answer is, yeah, but not compared to how many kids are out there.
And so when people say, well, why do you care so much about low income people getting an education? That fits in with the values of helping your fellow man. And the quickest way to get people out of poverty is to get an excellent education.
After Crow arrived, he was criticized when he created new departments and tailored coursework to what employers are looking for. In 2010, a Wall Street Journal survey identified ASU students as the fifth most sought after by major employers.
He's brought excellence to a new level. And in doing that, he has shaken up the status quo. And when you shake up the status quo, people start squealing like fat pigs. And they didn't like the change at first.
There are no more naysayers that I know of. Either they retired or they admitted they were wrong.
It's pretty clear by now that skeptics and critics aren't going to deter Michael Crow's determination to fix what he sees as a higher education system that is seriously out of date.
So we're at a very important social juncture point where I think that the public universities have got to step up and say, we're going to figure this out. We're going to figure out how to serve the nation.
Now Crow has formed an alliance with 11 other universities with 400,000 students to make school more accessible, more real-world practical, and not only for those who can afford it. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Tempe, Arizona.
On our calendar for Protestants, Sunday is Reformation Sunday, when they commemorate Martin Luther's nailing of 95 theses or complaints against the Catholic Church on the Wittenberg church door. Finally, the world's largest interfaith gathering concluded in Salt Lake City this week. Some 10,000 participants from 50 faith traditions attended the 2015 Parliament of the World's Religions. The event has been held once every 5 years since 1893. This year's gathering focused on several issues, including women in leadership, peace, and climate change. Delegates said it was important for the voices of people of faith to be heard in climate change debates. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more from the Parliament of the World's Religions.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.